I'm glad to be here today, and I want to thank all of you who are here to be part of this afternoon study. Not the very best time to be here, especially as I was walking out into the corridor, seeing the sunshine, and that's one reason. Other people may want to relax a little while after eating well, but I'm glad that we have this time together. And I thank you. When I come and stand in this way before you, I recall that all our children spent some years here at a time when we depended on some help for that to happen. And I assume, in different ways, all of you had a part in making that possible. So I think appreciatively of Great Lakes and people who have participated in that kind of ministry and support for the school here. So thank you for that, as well as just being here together today to study this subject. As a matter of fact, today, as in first century Corinth, I think, we face confusion and serious questions about marriage. To marry or not to marry? I think some that I was passing in the corridor might have assumed that's a question already beyond me. I don't need to be here. But in different ways, I think it remains a pertinent, critical question for our life together as God's people in the church. So what is the context of this question? Today, I think it might be asked in the widest way, with a view to the bounds, or some would call them restrictions, of marriage. How does it affect or limit sexual expression? Or it might be asked with a view to the responsibilities of marriage. What does that call for as I enter into this relationship? What is involved in marriage? Or people in the church setting might ask the question in view of the covenant that is formed, the faithfulness that is called for. What does that mean? And how does that, I think Christians would particularly want to ask, how does that enable, how does that form a person and enable a person to live more deeply in relationship? The question to marry or not to marry in view of that. Again, some may think this is not a real question. They take it for granted that upon reaching a certain age, I simply will marry. It is assumed in many ways for people in the culture and, I think, in the church as well. And this holds while we have more young people and older people who are single, who are part of society and the church. People who have been married, perhaps, but now single. It is therefore a real question to marry or not to marry. And so in this culture, to make our way, it is important to have a basic understanding of family, of marriage, and of singleness as it comes to us in this teaching from Paul. So in this session, the assignment is to think about the question specifically in light of 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And to do so, I think we need to set out some baselines. I have some of this set out on a PowerPoint, so if we could have the first of that now. Some of this we'll have to look at in more closely, but and establish this. But to start with, what is 1 Corinthians 7 about? First of all, I want to affirm that Paul is not presenting a complete teaching on marriage and the family. Rather, he is responding to specific questions that the Corinthians have set and sent to Paul in the letter. As the chapter opens, "Now concerning the matters about which you wrote, it is well for a man not to touch a woman." Speaking of sexual relations. "It is well for a man not to touch a woman" comes from, I want to say here, and we'll look at that more closely specifically, comes from not Paul, but from the Corinthians. And the reason why this is put in quotes in most recent translations of the New Testament. Again, just on that point, we might add that this has been confusing from very earliest time in the history of Christian interpretation, moving through stages where changes become apparent in understanding this chapter, and we will touch on that. Again, marriage or singleness both come up in the chapter. And both are, as Paul brings it to us, as right and good options. And that in itself will present us with a challenge for discernment and interpretation. How can they both be right and good? And at one point Paul says, better. Good and better about the two. Again, the sexual relationship within marriage is affirmed. That's where Paul begins in light of the slogan. There's no idea or no trace of an idea that sexual relationships within marriage are something less than good. That is something that comes out of another way of thinking in the culture at the time, and perhaps still to some extent in our time. Further, Paul speaks of gifts and call in relation to marriage and singleness. As here in 7:7, 7b, "Each has a particular gift from God," just speaking about marriage and single, "one having one kind and another a different kind." There he talks about gifts, and he can speak about both marriage and singleness. So those are some parameters or baselines within which to begin to think about the theme of 1 Corinthians 7. Now, we should have an overall perspective or sense of the chapter, and that's what I'd like for us to do fairly rapidly now. So, an outline, overall outline of 1 Corinthians 7. The first section deals with people in various marital states. To those who are married. And this is interesting. The NIV, in the earliest edition, talked about people in light of the challenge and the issue of immorality should get married. That's not what Paul is talking about. He's talking to married people already. This is to the married and how they are to sustain their marriage. So to the married, he says, maintain sexual relations. We'll touch on that again. And to the widowers and widows, he says, it is well to stay unmarried, but some will marry. Now, just here, it might be well to note that and ask whether Paul himself speaks from his own background and experience as a married person. Certainly in Jewish setting, as a Pharisee and a teacher, it was expected that that kind of person would be married. Strong expectation. And it is interesting here that Paul says in verse 8, to the unmarried and the widows, I say that it is well for them to remain unmarried as I am. It is notable that he puts this here in the context of people who are widows and widowers, as I am, right, in that setting. And that doesn't completely establish it, I think, but it may just be an indication that that is the category in which Paul, in light of his background, also belongs. It's, I think, quite possible that he was married and is now, for one reason or another, we don't know, there's nothing said about that, himself, a widower. Then we have Christian married couples. To them, we have the word of the Lord is no divorce. It's interesting that Paul would lift that up here. It matters, apparently, for Paul as to how much weight we give his words at different points. Here, he says in verse 10, to the married I give this command, not I, but the Lord, that the wife should not separate from her husband, husband should not divorce the wife, in verse 11. So the strong word. Here he gives complete, full weight to this statement because it comes from the Lord. Now we know Jesus taught about marriage and divorce in passages, in places like Mark chapter 10. So that may very well be what Paul is reflecting, that kind of teaching from the Lord. But he will go on in the next category when he talks about mixed marriages. He will say, to the rest, I say, I and not the Lord. There you have believers and unbelievers. How will they stay together? In certain contexts, in terms of thinking of that time, you might have said these people are incompatible and their marriage might be dissolved. But Paul does not see it in that way, that God calls and sustains this relationship, and that believers are to do so, and that their life in the Lord will sanctify those to whom they are married. And even, I think, if, you know, this depends on interpretation, but Paul anticipates that this may lead to faith and life in Christ, even of the partners, at a certain point later on. The possibility of that, he anticipates, I believe. So, in mixed marriages, Jesus did not have that in mind. Yet in his teaching, when he gave the teaching about marriage and divorce, he was speaking to people who have a common faith in God and live together as believers. But now Paul faces a situation where you have believer and unbeliever. So how does this word of Jesus about marriage and divorce fit, apply? So Paul does that kind of discernment, and he calls people to share that discernment, to participate in it with him. The next section provides general guidelines. And here, if we sum up what he's trying to say in light of the examples that he gives of circumcision and of slavery, it is that they are to remain where they were when called, when they came to faith in Jesus Christ. And why would he give that kind of direction to Christian people? When it comes to circumcision, uncircumcision, we know the issue in the early church over that and how they worked that out. What matters is faith in Jesus Christ And that is the basis of receiving the grace of God and living as the community of God's people. When it comes to slavery and freedom, to remain where you were, it's a significant word, I think. Paul says, were you a slave when called, verse 21, do not be concerned about it. To that extent, I agree with the NRSV. Paul is saying, don't invest your life, don't be preoccupied, whether it is about circumcision or slavery. You can serve and be God's person right where you are. And the interpretation there is difficult. One way of seeing it is, if you're a slave, just live all the more faithfully in that setting. And in part, that is right. But if you go on and read the whole passage, Paul is still saying, and the footnote in the NRSV says, take advantage of the opportunity, if you have it, to gain your freedom. So I think some form of that fits here, because Paul will say in verse 23, just in the same context, you were bought with a price, do not become slaves of human masters. So in some sense, the call to be a Christian is a call in the direction of freedom. And if that opens up, you don't have to be preoccupied, invest yourself in that. You can serve God as a slave, and many Christians certainly did. But if the opportunity is there, your life is in the direction of freedom in Christ, so move in that direction as you have opportunity, I think is how we might read it. We could come back, maybe we'll have time at the end to actually open up for a few questions. All right, so examples. Remain where you were when called. The next section, a longer section, that I think we might call counsel to engaged couples. Paul here speaks of virgins and so on, the betrothed. How do you, in that setting, work out the relationship? What does he have to say? And here he speaks of a present necessity. And in the light of this particularly, stay as you are. If you are unmarried, don't seek a wife. If you're married, stay there. And clearly he's talking about what the NRSV calls the present crisis, or some translations impending crisis, but that word normally always is translated present. And I think he is talking about a present circumstance, necessity, a constraint that is present for people. And it's interesting, Bruce Winter, a person who studied the historical social context of Corinth to a great length, makes the point that during these years, I think it was three times, there's a man appointed to see that the people in a time of famine will be provided bread, provided food. Much of that brought from Egypt and elsewhere. But it was a critical time. Just right around the time that Paul was actually doing ministry, and then a few years after that, writing his letters. So that may at least be part of the present necessity. It's a dire time for many people. And Paul says, don't try to make big changes in your life. Try to live at peace in the circumstances in which you are, and you will have less anxiety. That's how he concludes this point to some extent, isn't it? In verse 35, particularly, this word fits there, I think. I say this for your benefit, not to put any restraint upon you, when he talks about staying married or unmarried, but to promote good order and unhindered or undistracted devotion to the Lord. That's what he's concerned about. There is his priority of devotion to God. And what we see through the whole passage is that peace is a value. Peace in their living, but also in their relationships. If you're constantly moving, if you're constantly thinking, I've got to be someplace else, be doing something else, what happens? You're under stress and maybe in conflict with your situation and with people around you. So he says he wants them not to live with anxiety, but to be able to live with some peace as Christian people. That in many circumstances could have application, but here in the context of particularly marriage and family. So these further considerations Paul provides, the present situation, constraint, and he also goes on to speak of the time is short. And this, the form of this age is passing away in 31. So it's not only the present circumstance, it's also the fact that Paul thinks of the fact that you're a people of the kingdom that will be consummated. So, and this age is not where you belong. This is not where you're rooted. You're rooted in the kingdom of God. So anticipate and live your life in light of the kingdom and the coming of Jesus Christ. Again, that could be a question that we can focus on more fully. And finally, he, in the question about to marry or not to marry, a bottom line there is you have freedom to choose depending on your needs, your desires, your relationships. But in some ways, he says, in many circumstances, it is well not to move, or if you're a single person, to marry. You may better be able to serve the Lord with full devotion as a single person. So at the verse 39 through 40, we have counsel, finally, a kind of summary to wives and widows. The woman bound to her husband as long as he lives, but then if he dies, free to marry. And kind of a little summary at the end. Some people there might have said, we have the Spirit, and we are not bound in these physical relationships. Paul says, I think I have the Spirit also. And he's not so spiritual that he can't talk about marriage and living in fulfillment of that relationship, right? So he counters their word in some ways. So now, in light of the whole chapter before us, what do we say? Very simply, there is a place for marriage and for singleness, I think. We can begin there. And in this context, we might examine, think about more, the slogan, it is well for a man not to touch a woman, speaking of sexual relations. And Paul does think that of life as in singleness or celibacy as a good thing. Right? In verse 7, I wish that all were as I myself am. And in verse 8, to the married and widows, it is well for them to remain unmarried as I am. And you can go down through the chapter and find other references. Verse 27, are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be free. Are you free from a wife? Do not seek a wife. So the anxiety that usually occupies people in our culture about getting married, and that's the main direction, Paul says there are two directions here for people, two ways to move as a person, as God's person. And he opens that up in different ways. For this reason, the apostle does not entirely reject the slogan, but he qualifies it clearly. If you follow it, read closely here, it is well for a man not to touch a woman, but, notice, immediately, but, right? And he had said, just before that, he's responding to questions that they had written to him about. So at different points, he seems to highlight something that they have said and then responds. He doesn't entirely reject it, but he has a but, a contrast, and he will qualify it. First of all, and he says in terms of who we are as sexual beings, you should recognize that people can be tempted and led into immorality and fornication. And if your marriage is not worked out, you can be an obstacle in that marriage. And so he's realistic in that sense. He says to think simply in terms of that slogan is not realistic about who we are as sexual beings, and calls for fuller, more realistic understanding. The Corinthians apparently were thinking to take this into marriage itself, right? To abstain from sexual relations with your partner in marriage is a good thing, they would have said. But Paul is clear that he's not talking about this kind of spiritual marriage. Not realistic, not in accord with who we are. Rather, he says, in two following, the husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. For the wife does not rule, does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement for a set time to devote yourselves to prayer, and then come together again. Very specific and clear about sexual relationship there in terms of marriage. People who said, so spiritual, we abstain. He says, no, you belong together as a couple. And you have obligations, rights. And it's interesting that here, in that culture particularly, it is a mutual submission, isn't it? In this most intimate of relationships, a mutual relationship. The husband would have said, I married you, you are here for me in that time, in that place. But here Paul says this goes both ways, for the man and for the woman. So it affirms the good of sexual relations within marriage. Today, in our sexualized culture, we might wonder about the need for this kind of instruction, right? Do husbands and wives need that? And I think we have to put ourselves in their context. If we assume, as the Corinthians seem to have done, that sexuality is a part of a fleshly, unspiritual existence, then we may think that we should renounce it to be truly holy people. But Paul does not go there. He doesn't open that way, but affirms the relationship. But this was the air, was in the air and in the culture in that time. Among certain groups, for instance, like the Stoics and the Cynics, and as we were there just 3 weeks ago on the grounds of the Qumran community, walking their little paths, their mikvah, there was a community of ascetics who lived celibate lives. And Philo and others affirm, they look up to that kind of life, a way of life. So there, these are people in Jewish setting and Gentile who thought that to pursue a life of virtue and wisdom, it was best to abstain from sexual relations and the responsibilities of family life. The Stoic Musonius Rufus argued that sexual desire, even within marriage, could be justified only for the purpose of begetting children. It is unlawful when it is simply the fulfillment of desire or pleasure. When it is simply delight in the partner. It is only for procreation. But note that Paul does not affirm sexuality in that way, even as in later Christian history people often did almost exactly that. In the early church, marriage and sexuality are affirmed. Beyond the New Testament, we have Clement of Alexandria, about 180, who critiques the disparagement that is found among the Gnostics on marriage. And he does it precisely by referring to this text and the way Paul affirms sexual relations. Again, Origen, who we know had his own struggles with sexuality, nevertheless, he understood this slogan about not touching a woman as a Corinthian confusion about the abstinence, about abstinence as a good thing. And he said to the man, "This is an abuse of your wife." Persons enter marriage with the expectation that includes sexual relationship. And your partner may not be able to endure your purity or your ascetic spirituality. And bluntly, he says, sleep with your wife. In the light of what he sees in Paul. Even though he lived as a single man, one of the great interpreters in early and teachers in early Christian history. So marriage and sexual relationship are affirmed. A turning point comes with Cyprian in the mid-3rd century. And then in the 4th century, this is deepened with Athanasius and Ambrose. Each of them wrote treatises on the glory of virginity. In fact, Ambrose, in the 350s to 70s in there, wrote 7 treatises on the subject. You can see how much of a prominence this was gaining then. And this is also the time when celibacy became a vocation. That is, a way of life for certain groups, clergy in the church and monks and so on, nuns. They were not all in their full form yet, but teaching began to shape and form Christian groups. So now what is lifted up from this chapter is living in singleness, and singleness as better, right? And the move is decisively represented in the bishop Methodius, about 320, who interprets the slogan in 1 Corinthians 7:1 as from Paul, and he says this is a command from Paul for celibacy. And now marriage begins to be seen as a second best, as for those who find it a necessity. So our reading so far from Corinthians 7, marriage and sexuality within marriage is affirmed. At the same time, Paul in 7:7, people have different gifts. Some for marriage and some for singleness. That much I think we can see already from this first section of the chapter. So how do we work with this statement? Marriage is good. Singleness is better. We want to qualify immediately, I think, in some circumstances, right? And I think when Paul fills that all out, we can say that. But let's arrive there. I think the reason this is important to highlight is that in our setting, if we look on our map of Christian understanding, there has basically been room for only one thing on that map. That is marriage. Move toward marriage, expect to get married. But Paul opens up both paths. So in this frame of marriage is good and singleness, quote, sometimes is better, we are called to discernment, to think in fresh ways about marriage and singleness. We are called to think about marriage and singleness in the framework of the gift and call of God for both. The priority, as he says, is undivided devotion to God, married or single, 735. But he makes clear that this call to devotion, undivided devotion to God, opens up space for singleness for many people, right? Today, in the culture and in church, we often simply assume that people come by two. Right, invite somebody to a party or a group in the church, and bring your partner, bring your husband, bring your wife. You expect that, even if we didn't say that, right? Where is your other half, right? We assume it very often. People come by two. In programs or classes in the church, we might even set up a class for singles. But what's the background assumption? This is set up so they can find each other. Right. Not that they might go there simply to work together, to encourage each other as single people who have found God's way to fulfill that in their lives. A different way to think. But that's how Paul is, I believe, thinking. So we can say that in many ways, only now I guess in certain contexts, but marriage may be idolized and singleness marginalized. We do need to think about singles in the church. But because all of us, whether married or single, need closeness, sharing of life, accountability, support. How do we do that? I think we do that often more, but often less well than we might. We're not aware sometimes even. It does take two people in different ways in many circumstances of life, whether it's talking things through at the end of the day or whether it is putting up a shelf, two people or more, to do it. So we do need that kind of support, awareness in our life, in the church. I think of our church in Stony Creek. I think now we have as many people who are single in the church, and different, you know, many of them older, who have lost their mates, who are part of our church, some by divorce. Single people. And we have to think about how we include them in fellowship and ministry. So moving toward marriage then is not automatic or simply to be expected. And we might just add that being single is not what needs to be justified. It is taking the step toward marriage normally that we need to ask about the call of God on our life, right? What is my calling? What is God's will? What is my gift? Beyond marriage itself, it is a question of this person, this marriage, this time, in God's way for me, God's will for me. So, not singleness, but marriage that we need to justify, in which we need to ask about the will of God for our life. And I think this moves us decisively beyond the simple romantic notion in the culture that to be complete, one has to be married. Of course, one of the great gifts and blessings of marriage is partnership. And that is never to be negated. And Paul does not. In different ways, he lifts that up here. And he does so in other places, like 1 Thessalonians 4 and Ephesians 5. But that still leaves open, as Paul brings it to us, the call of God to marriage and to singleness as well. The idea, the notion that we simply need another person to complete us may be a form of idolatry, harmful not only to singles, but also to the marrieds. It brings inevitable frustration and disappointment, I think, if we look at it that way. I recalling some years ago, a friend of mine saying, this was the expectation we both had in coming to the marriage. But I had to realize, and my wife had to realize, I couldn't be just there for her and she here for me. That we are creatures rooted as creatures in God, not in each other. And as a Christian, I'm not called to follow a spouse, I'm called to follow Jesus Christ. So the relationship seen aright in the light of Christ and in this recognition of the will of God for marriage and for singleness. So it moves us beyond the idea that our desires too are the most important thing in order to fulfill to live a full life. In our culture, there are subtle and blatant ways in which we are urged, do what feels good. And the church may turn away in denial from this reality. It's not just that we need rules about not having sex. We need to be the church to hear the gospel, where we can be accountable as people, that will help us reject the idea, the lie, that desire is the most important thing, so that we can move on to think about and reflect on as Christian people on what is worth desiring, worthwhile in our life to desire. Let me round this out with some concluding reflections. Here, both marriage and singleness are affirmed, which means that we are called to deeper discernment, to discernment in a way that perhaps we have not often done. Each person, Paul says, has a particular gift from God in marriage and in singleness. Specifically, the apostle says, he who marries does well, and he who refrains from marriage does better. How can we put that together? 7:38. It has a context. But we wanted to say, it has to be one way or the other, right? If something is better, that's the right way for us. And that, in some ways, was the temptation that we meet already in the church in the 3rd century. Marriage becomes second best, only for those that absolutely need it, right? And Paul never says that. Good and better takes account of circumstances and needs and relationships and life. And for some, it can be simply affirmed in that way, I think. So here we do need to look at context. Paul has talked about the present necessity or crisis, as it is in the NRSV. And in that setting, particularly to say, it is well for you to remain as you are. And then, of course, he also speaks of the time that has grown short and the present world passing away. Not to think of our life simply in terms of this world and the concerns and interests of our culture, but to think in terms of our relationship to Jesus Christ, of the kingdom in which we share, and in light of that, to make our discernments and responses. And in that setting, as Paul moves through this, it is clear that the single person often is better able to fulfill certain callings in his life than the married person. Not to say that the reverse is not also true in other circumstances, I think. Here I'm speaking and not Paul. Finally, here too, peace is a value for the purpose of devoted service in different circumstances. For some, that will mean singleness. Paul is clear. And as I have gone on to say, for others, it will mean getting married. If the relationship, if we can paraphrase Paul here, if the relationship and the desire for marriage is strong, some people will be more able, better fit to serve in partnership. And Paul says, let them marry. And apparently, with this high-sounding spirituality, there were some who were saying, that's not possible to be truly spiritual. But Paul says, they do not sin. Let them marry. Right? He's doing it in a context of controversy to some extent and of contrast. But let them marry. They do not sin. It's a good. Marriage is a good. The relationship of marriage is good. And Paul himself, in his letters, recognizes that many times married people fit well together as partners. Think of the New Testament and couples you meet. Priscilla and Aquila. A great couple in Corinth, Ephesus, and Rome. They moved around. That would, in some ways, you would think that might work better for single people. Right? But here was a couple, probably without children. We never have any indication. Who were able to move around. And Paul commends them again and again in his letters. Romans 16 is one example of that. And there are other couples in that list of his in Romans 16 of couples who worked together as partners and provided great service and ministry in the church. But we can also think of single people around Paul, can't we? Timothy and Titus, I think. Timothy was quite clearly single. But single people who were able to move here and there readily and whose call was to a single life to serve and carry the gospel and serve the church. So in single life and marriage, to serve God without distraction, in full devotion, he says, to God. Well, I think I'll stop there and... maybe we can have